Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up later in the show, Massachusetts Congressman Mike Capuano on the government shutdown and today's effort by House Republicans to fund a partial restart of the federal government. That's coming up later this hour.
But first, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Paul Harding. His new novel, Enon, begins with these words.
Most men in my family make widows of their wives and orphans of their children. I am the exception. My only child, Kate, was struck and killed by a car while riding her bicycle home from the beach one afternoon in September, a year ago. She was 13. My wife, Susan, and I separated soon afterward.
A sharp knife needs no adornment. The blade just cuts straight to the bone. Such, too, is the power of Paul Harding's prose. In 2010, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his debut novel, Tinkers, a book that told the story of the death and life of New Englander George Washington Crosby. Now Harding continues the story of the Crosby family in the new book, Enon, and he joins us in the studio to talk about it. Paul Harding, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks so much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
It is so wonderful to have you back. But I have to say, Paul, so I was on vacation last week in New Hampshire, and I had your book. I had Enon with me. And I was there with my family, my husband and our dog, and my three-year-old daughter, right? Mm. And so I read the first page and a half of Enon, and that first paragraph, just the stark right. description of the death of 13-year-old Kate. And I just put the book down, and I just thought, I can't do this. I can't read it. I mean, the power, just looking at my daughter, the power of it was so incredible. So my first question to you is, have you ever experienced the kind of grief that that Charlie Crosby, the father of 13-year-old Kate, undergoes in the book Enon?
I haven't experienced it directly, but I'm a parent. I have two sons. And I remember the powerful feeling of when my first son was born, really sort of having this kind of revelation that for the first time in my life, I realized that something could happen that would threaten to just sort of completely unhinge me, which would be the loss of a child. It's also the case, too, that I have dear friends who have lost children. And, you know, when I'm up at night sleepless and worried about the world, those are often the people I am up sleepless over. So it was a kind of, you know, being a novelist, it's the novelist's job to imagine his way into these kind of, you know, the most sort of intense, meaningful, irreducible human experiences.
Right. And this is a particularly that kind of thing. I mean, the contours of the grief of a parent who's lost a child are utterly unique, I think.
Right. I think that's right. And I think part of the reason why that first paragraph is just so stark and straight to the point is I realized very early on that if the basic dramatic premise of the book was a parent losing a child, that if I took one false step in any direction, it would lapse into sentimentality or bathos, and I just wanted to put all the cards right on the table, get right to the point, and then discipline myself for the rest of the composition of the book to, you know, the story is in the telling. There's no place to hide here. Mm-hmm. You have to go straight through it and look at kind of, you know, straight in the eye mm-hmm. the whole way through.
So the central character in Enon is Charlie Crosby, who we see in your debut novel, Tinkers.
Very briefly, right? Yeah, a little cameo. He reads to the protagonist of Tinkers.
Yeah, because it's his grandfather, George right. Washington Crosby, who is the story in Tinkers
right. yeah.
several generations earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just, there's a lot that I want to dig into about Enon and the place and how you wrote it. But why is it that you decided to basically write a series of novels that take place within different generations of the same family? Because a lot of times writers will write, you know, a series that deal with the same character over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a generational series.
Yeah, and I mean, my all-time role model for that is William Faulkner and his Yoknapatawpha County. And I love, you know, as a reader, one of my favorite feelings that reading can generate, from the most sort of trivial, literal little things to the deepest, profoundest subjects. But it's the experience of recognition. So when you're reading a book and suddenly the protagonist of another book sort of walks across in the background. You say, I know that guy. I read the book about him. And all of a sudden, the single book that's in your hand becomes something bigger because it's attached to other narratives. And I like this idea of over a series of novels writing about different generations, different families, but kind of in the same place.
Right. I mean, different families, but they are families that are connected.
Yeah, and in this case, yeah, they're all Crosbys. So, yeah.
And that's interesting to me because sort of history redounds within our families on each other in kind of interesting ways.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, because there's a moment early in Enon where Charlie Crosby is remembering his daughter, Kate, and remembering describing his grandfather, you know, to her in a way when she says, I almost feel like I know him, too.
Right, right. Yeah, and I feel that's something that I have with my sons. I was so close with my own grandfather that my sons actually said what Kate says. I just gave her one of their lines, which is, you tell me so much about your grandfather that I feel like I know him. And there's that strange sort of reciprocity where I look at my children and I can see my grandfather in them. So there's that beautiful kind of transgenerational resonance that I think that's, you know, everybody, like you're saying, everybody sort of experiences that. You go to the family reunion and somebody says, oh, you're just like your great uncle Joe on your, and you think, this is somebody I've never met before yet. There's the kind of the familial sort of aspect of identity.
Right. So tell us, give us the nutshell of what happens to Charlie Crosby in Enon.
Well, it's a rough ride he goes through. His marriage, which is already fairly fragile, breaks up quite quickly. It was a young marriage that sort of held together while the child that he and his wife loved in common is taken out of the equation. The marriage dissolves, and then Enon it basically covers from his daughter's death until the first anniversary of her death, and he becomes unhinged, and he really he starts to drink too much. He breaks his hand in a moment of anger and starts to abuse painkillers and really just becomes unraveled. And so most of the book is about him. He's a conscience, though. He's acutely aware through all of his misadventures that that he's not living up to what he'd want his daughter to think of him as, you know, posthumously. You know, he imagines his way back and forth between this life and the afterlife and her in it. And so it's just his struggles to sort of improvise a way to survive the grief and to try to find, you know, against what seem like impossible odds, a way for hope and love to be stronger than the devastation.
Yeah. So what I found, one of the many, many things I found fascinating in this beautiful book is in Tinkers, in your debut novel, George Washington Crosby, he's an elderly man who's dying, essentially, dies.
Yep.
But in sort of the act of his dying, it unleashes his consciousness, and we hear the story of his life unfolding. And in a sense, I kind of feel like in the middle of Enon, Charlie Crosby is experiencing a partial kind of death too, because doesn't a part of you as a parent die when your child is so abruptly taken from you?
Yeah, I think there's that. There are all sorts of contradictions, and that's what actually makes it so difficult, is that you're obliterated by grief, but you still notice every detail. You know, you're still, all of your five senses are still there, and so one of the tragedies is that life actually totally keeps going on, even though you have been completely devastated. And I don't know. It's
well, because he's alone, right? I mean,
right,
he spends this year virtually alone, drinking, taking painkillers, abusing painkillers, hardly seeing his neighbors, having these waking fantasies about his daughter.
Right. He speculates on that. He has that strange, again, there's that self-awareness of he knows what he's doing. He knows he shouldn't be doing it. And yet he does talk about I kind of have one foot in the grave. I'm almost becoming a ghost myself.
Right.
And because everything he imagines, too, he spends all of his time imagining sort of Kate Sort of repatriated into the, you know, into this kind of ghost version of the town with everybody who's lived there since colonial times.
Yeah.
And he understands that he's sort of going deeper. And it's at one point he understands that it's almost an attenuated form of suicide that he's starting to kind of commit by attrition, mm-hmm. almost.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the place that this mm-hmm. is set, Enon, the fictional town of Enon, which is actually inspired by a real place in Massachusetts. But in order to do that, I would love for you to read a little passage of the book. And this is where Charlie Crosby is remembering an interaction that he had with his daughter, Kate, before she passed away.
Right. And so they're in the Audubon together, looking at feeding birds. Kate looked at the bird and smiled. The bird sang a liquid, silvery little phrase that was so clear and so limpid it seemed without source, trilling in the air for an instant and evaporating without a trace. Afterward, whenever Kate and I talked about her first time feeding the birds, we ended our recollections by talking about the little yellow bird and the little silver phrase it sang that neither of us could have said quite for certain we had actually heard, but for the fact that the other seemed to have heard it as well. The bird remained on the tip of Kate's finger for another moment and whirred back into the reeds. I tried to sight it with my binoculars, but could not find it again. We crossed the boardwalk, walked up the log steps in the woods, and into the milkweed field, which was full of swallows zinging around, catching insects on the wing in the sunset. Kate rubbed her arm and said, "Oh, man, I must have fed like 100 birds. That pretty little yellow one was the best. I couldn't even feel it on my fingers."
That's Paul Harding reading a passage from his new novel, Enon. I loved that passage because... To be honest, the book is not an easy read. I mean, it is a profound exploration of a unique and terrible kind of grief.
Mm-hmm.
But it is shot through with these little memories of Charlie being a dad.
Yeah, absolutely.
To Kate. Now, tell us where this scene actually takes place, right? It's inspired by a real place.
Well, so I live in Topsfield. I grew up in Wenham. They're towns right next to each other up on the North Shore. And this is basically set in the Ipswich River Wildlife Sanctuary, which you can actually go to, and the birds will feed from your hands. The chickadees are tame there. And so I had, in my own life, I had wonderful experiences with my own grandfather. He took me there, and, you know, there's in a scene not unlike that in Enon, the first time when I was a young kid, you know, maybe 12 years old, and I've been there, back there many times with my own sons. And so again, you know, it's fiction, but I'm writing, you know, you have to, because you care about your characters and their souls, you have to keep them close to your own heart. You have to treat their hearts and their souls the way you'd treat your own and the souls of your children and your loved
right.
ones.
And Enon itself was the name of your hometown, Wenham, before it was incorporated in what, 1642?
I think it's 1623. 16 you know, but yeah, it's one of the early ones. Yeah. And Enon is just like an old, derived from an old Hebrew word that means watery place, and Wenham has Wenham Lake, which is famous for its ice that they exported to England, and there's swamps there and all sorts of water. It means watery place.
Well, I want to ask you, you know, you talked a little bit earlier about the grief that your character Charlie feels and how that really heightens his awareness of all manner of detail.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Now, there have been some critics who reviewed the book and who say that basically your prose is so luminous and so precise and so insightful, but they think that it doesn't really match what a grief-stricken parent would be experiencing.
That's... Being a fiction writer, to me, I write from the character outwards, you know? And so to withhold a character his own experience of grief in order to satisfy a kind of improvised, normative, theoretical definition of grief is ridiculous. You know, I mean, people who it's absurd, because what you're basically doing is you're basically telling people they can't have their own experience of mm-hmm. their own humanity and their own senses. In that sense, Enon is not about grief. It's about Charlie Crosby, who experiences grief. And he is a thoughtful guy who notices all the, you know, things around him. And he uses the local history, the local landscape, all of those things through which to refract the memories of his daughter, and he populates her in those places. And I think of that as almost like it's a coping mechanism. It's the same like with Perseus and Medusa. If he looks at it directly, he'll turn to stone. He'll be astonished out of existence. But if he uses the kind of the mirror of the town and its history and puts her in it and can look at it through these reflections and these imaginings of her, somehow or another, he feels like he might be able to survive it.
So let me ask you, there's something I've always wondered about how you write, because many critics have accurately described your writing. Again, I just use those words, precise, luminous, insightful, profound. I mean, for example, there's a sentence in early in the book where you just simply write, "Time is mercy." And it's in a scene where Charlie Crosby is essentially coming to terms with the fact that his marriage is going to end, mm-hmm. and that he sees time as a merciful thing to let things play out as they must.
Right.
But that word mercy, I thought, does Paul Harding sit at his desk and sort of carve away and think, time is charity, time is torture? I mean, like, how do you fall upon that right word?
So, I mean, that pretty much describes it. There's a lot of, feeling around in the dark. I mean, I write in a very kind of interrogative, improvisational way. I mean, there's endless revision. But when you're there and you're live and you're coming up with that the first impression, the first vision, you're trying to get it down, it's absolutely true that my prime goal is precision. Precision is of the utmost importance, because if you describe things precisely, you describe them in their own actual beauty, and you improve your odds of not just sort of slathering on your own kind of stylistic, ornamental, you won't prettify things. If you just get something in itself, its true beauty will come through. The true lucidity will come through. So, and in that case, it's just he's trying to foreshorten his suffering. He's almost, kind of projecting himself into the future when he will not hurt so much, and he realizes that he can't do it, so that time will be the only way that mercy is finds its way into his heart in that instance.
You know, Paul, we've just got a couple minutes to go here. So much more to talk to you about. We'll just have to have you back.
But, wonderful.
But, I've heard you say previously that you consider yourself a self-taught modern New England transcendentalist. But what I wonder about that is, for example, I mean, Emerson called transcendentalism a form of optimism, or a complex idealism.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But Enon, at its heart, is it an optimistic book?
Absolutely. 100%. Yes. It is meant to put, I mean, in some ways, that's almost the aesthetic, that's the aesthetic core of the book that I wanted to explore and to work out, which was for all of the book is not nihilistic, but it's about the threat of meaninglessness. It's about the threat of obliteration by grief and by loss. And so it gets darker and darker and darker and darker. But the idea is that even if at the end there's the smallest bit of light, that bit of light will be all the more piercing and lucid and beautiful for the fact that it contradicts that darkness, and the strength that is required in these kind of tragedies, these human tragedies. You have to be incredibly strong to be able to still find hope, mm-hmm. In the face of apparent hopelessness. And it's not a spoiler alert to say that Charlie Crosby affirms and says yes to this world, even at the end, for all of its darkness. And for the modesty of that yes, he still says yes.
Well, the modesty of that yes, sometimes that's all you need, right? The ability to say yes, modest or not.
Right.
Well, Paul Harding's new novel is Enon. It is a spectacular, emotional read. I have to say, I was telling you a little earlier before we started the show that I was reading parts of it over lunch in tears, but the good kind of tears. Congratulations on the book, Paul. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for the wonderful conversation. Appreciate it.
And listeners, you can also listen back to our conversation with Paul back when he won the Pulitzer Prize in 2010 for Tinkers. That's at our website, radioboston.org. But stick with us, because up next we'll hear from Congressman Mike Capuano about the state of the government shutdown. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.